Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars.
The show where we bring you the every... Oh, no! Damn! The show where we cover every Best Picture nominee from 1927 to today.
I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm still Ryan.
And we're back with kind of the tagline. It's close.
You know.
It's close.
Well, here's the thing. You start panicking because you got it wrong, yeah. And then you don't say the right thing. You say close to the right thing.
And you know what? The message got it. It's you, the point across.
I did it.
I'm struggling too. Anyway, here we are talking about movies from the third Academy year.
Yeah.
Still.
Our second to last movie that we're going to cover before our ceremonies.
Third to last, technically, we recorded out of order.
Oh.
Sorry.
I'm batting zero so far. Yeah.
Which next week you won't hear us say. Hey, for those who celebrate it, Merry Christmas. But that's we meant right. to.
We did mean to say that.
We meant to say it. So if you're listening next week in the future, Merry Christmas.
I did almost wear my Santa Claus is coming to town. It's like he's playing hockey at the North Pole.
Yeah.
I have a long sleeve of that. I almost wore that today. But I'm going to the movie theaters with Taylor. And I did think that in the middle of November, people would look at me weird if I was wearing like a Santa hockey.
What shirt. Movie are you going to see?
The Running Man.
They'd buy it.
You think so?
Yeah they'd buy it.
If I was seeing Wicked, I think people would be okay.
You think so?
I think so.
I don't know. I feel like Santa playing hockey, athleticism.
That's a man running.
This isn't your dad's Santa Claus, you know? This is a man who's ready to do what he's got to do.
That was my favorite tagline for David Harbour's Violent Night.
Oh, I forgot that movie exists.
Well, look forward to the sequel next year.
I forgot that was happening too. So today we're talking about Infidelity.
We are, yes. The Divorcee, to be exact. Mm. What can you tell us about The Divorcee, Kyle?
I can tell you that it came out in 1930. It was directed by Robert Z. Leonard. This is an MGM production, and this is starring Norma Shearer as Jerry Martin, returning fan favorite Chester Morris as her husband Ted Martin.
And another returning favorite.
Yeah, Conrad Nagel as Paul. Also, Robert Montgomery is in this movie.
I do want to point out Robert Montgomery is Don, and we'll get to him, but I don't want to leave out Don.
No, he's a treat.
He is a treat.
That's what Jerry said, too. Oh my God. Uh-oh. This was based on a book by Ursula Perrot. Is that how you pronounce that? Perrot? Or is it Perot? I don't know, but it was called Ex-Wife, which was also the alternative title for this film.
It's spelled Parrot. I'm going to say Parrot.
I'm going to say Parrot too.
If there's like one R and one T, maybe it's Perot, but no, that's Parrot.
Yeah.
That's okay. So you mentioned what this was nominated for, correct?
I did not.
But this was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Writing.
And?
Best Actress.
Thank you.
So Norma Shearer was nominated for Best Actress for her role as Jerry in this. So The Divorcee, we're coming off talking about a couple of other movies, right? Mm-hmm. We've covered Disraeli, we'll cover All Quiet on the Western Front. So with The Divorcee, I was kind of getting a little bit of like, I anticipated Love Parade.
Yeah.
Right? The idea of a sex comedy, so to speak, with The Divorcee, I was kind of expecting some like maybe mildly raunchy humor, but more along the lines of The Love Parade. Very pleased with this overall. This definitely felt, even the very beginning, it feels more like, I mean, these are very much adults, but it felt kind of like a teen comedy.
Okay, yeah.
And maybe it's because it opens up on a cabin. I guess before we do that, I should probably speak a little bit more to the plot. So Jerry and Ted are going to be our main characters here specifically, and they're in love. So happy, so idyllic.
Very in love.
And at the same time, Paul is also in love with Jerry. And... Correct. That's correct. Sorry, you looked at me. I was like, "Did I get the name?"
Oh, I was starting to look shocked because we're getting saucy.
It's a little salacious. Yeah. So Paul is in love with Jerry, but knows that she's with Ted. And at the same time, Jerry has a sister named Dorothy, who she calls Dot.
Yeah.
And Ted, Jerry, Paul, and Dorothy are at this little cabin having some fun with some friends, just drinking.
Massive cabin.
Massive cabin.
These are wealthy people.
I want to point out, there's an opening, not an opening shot, but there's a shot pretty early on of this cabin, and you see everyone downstairs talking and, you know, playing some card games, having fun. And then there's a shot where they call everyone down for dinner. And there's an establishing shot of the upstairs from downstairs. And it's a beautiful set design. Mm-hmm. So you can see like people coming out of rooms while also seeing everyone downstairs doing everything they're doing. And to me, this was really, really fun because it just felt very much like they didn't have to do this, right? This movie doesn't necessitate like incredible filmography, and it's not something, hey, look where the camera's going. Very cool that they just built out. This cabin doesn't show up again. Right? This is kind of a one-off shot.
Yeah, this is just the opening of the movie.
And you can see like people coming out. It almost reminded me of like Ants in a Colony, mm-hmm. of just kind of like different places and they're moving in different, you know, locations. Very much loved this shot. And it kind of added to a quirkiness, or at least a little bit of like, oh, what's this? Like inquisitive side.
Yeah.
So really loved that. But Ted and Jerry, thick as thieves. They want to get married. They're talking about getting married. And at the same time, Paul is hoping he has a shot, but he learns he doesn't. And this drives Paul a little depressed, starts drinking, and they're going to leave. They're talking about leaving the party and hanging out. And Paul does not let Ted drive. He insists on driving himself. Mm-hmm. He's being a little sad boy, and he's all depressed and drunk. And he has more or less caused some problems to where now he is driving a car with Dot, Paul, and Jerry in the car. Ted in the car. Mm. Paul's driving, and he starts driving recklessly. Before we talk any further, let me ask you, Kyle, how did you feel about the shot of Paul driving with a green screen, or at least a version of a green screen behind him, of how recklessly he was driving?
It's Evil Dead.
It's Evil Dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's at one point, I want you to think, audience, I want you to think about putting a camera right in front of you and then tilting it left and right very ferociously. And this is what they're doing with the background, to a point though, where I do actually think, and I tried to send a screenshot to you and I didn't have any luck doing it, i.e. I forgot, where they're turning around a corner. And I do think that they suggest that the car is on two wheels, or at least on its side.
Ooh, nice.
Because there is like a shot where just like the highway is like vertical to their like image.
Right.
And I was like, okay.
He's getting wild.
He's getting wild.
Look, he may have been.
I mean, that's the end result, right?
Yeah.
Is the car turned over. So to Kyle's point, just think Evil Dead.
Paul becomes a Kandarian demon and just flips the car.
So he does flip the car. He is driving erratically. He does flip the car and does horribly disfigure the face of Dorothy, Jerry's sister, Dot.
Yeah. Is it Jerry's sister?
It is Jerry's sister.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So that's what makes the events that happen a little more confusing, but we'll get there. So because of this, Paul feels awful. Jerry's digging into him. And he then dedicates his life, being so remorseful of this, to marry Dot and be together with her, even to a point where the next shot that we see is a wedding, but it's kind of in his head. And the actual wedding is him standing by her table. Actually, now that I think of it, that's not it. That's Jerry and Ted's wedding, right?
Jerry and Ted's wedding.
And then it's just smash cut with Paul and Dot getting married while she's in her hospital bed, wrapped up.
Exactly.
Because of her horrible disfigurement.
Yeah.
So it shows the duality of, like, you know, the amazing wedding day of Ted and Jerry. And then the what almost feels like he's throwing her a bone, and Dorothy.
It's a wedding, a marriage based entirely on guilt.
Yes. And this is essentially the premise of our movie, is now we have these four people whose lives are now cemented in two and two in different places. And we follow Ted and Jerry. Ted and Jerry are our main characters. Mm-hmm. And we watch them live their lives. So this is an interesting one to talk about, because I feel like with most times that we talk about movies, the plot of it kind of kicks in around the 10 to 15 minute mark. But the title aspect of this movie doesn't really kick in until like maybe an hour?
Yeah, it takes quite a bit of time to get there.
Because the divorcee is referring to both Ted and Jerry's status as being divorced. And that really doesn't happen until about an hour into the movie. We're more watching kind of like the seeds being planted.
Right.
And this ends up being a lot more of a, I mentioned that teen romp that, it reminded me of in the beginning. And you kind of see that throughout, right? There's a scene pretty early on where Ted and Jerry are having an anniversary party. It's their third anniversary. And they have a couple friends over. And of those friends is Don, who you previously mentioned. So Don, played by Robert Montgomery, I want to point him out real quick. So he has a scene, and this is where I'm still trying to figure out the tone of this movie, right? He has a scene where there's another friend, not really sure of his name. He kind of just shows up once. He has an organ grinder on him. You know what I'm talking about?
An organ grinder.
Or a grinder.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
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 So he has like a grinder, like a, that you would play on like the streets.
Right.
And there'd be like a little monkey dancing. So at one point, he pulls out this grinder and he starts playing. And Don then lowers himself about 5 inches and points. I don't know if you've ever seen this image of John Lennon when he's walking. And it's him kicking his like knees out left and right very drastically. And he's walking very like low. And his feet just kind of like fly out from in front of him as
sounds
he's
like
walking.
He's doing like a Charlie Chaplin.
He's doing a little bit of a Charlie Chaplin thing. And then that proceeds to be what Don does here. Mm-hmm. And while this man is playing the grinder, Don walks around like a monkey trying to get money from all the people at the party. And this has no significance in the movie at all. I just want to point out that I thought this was hilarious. And I was just absolutely dying at the idea of this man kicking his feet out like John Lennon in that image and just pretending to be a monkey while this man played the grinder. So that was the best part of this movie.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Well, it was the funniest part of the movie for me, at least. But this does start sowing the seeds of where someone's introduced to the party. Who's introduced at this party, Kyle?
That's going to be Janice, which really makes me laugh because I always think of Friends.
Yeah, Janice.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. And that's exactly how I reacted when she walks into the kitchen following Ted while he goes to make drinks. This is the twist of the movie. This is where the happy-go-lucky relationship of Ted and Jerry takes a turn because you find out that Ted has had an affair with Janice.
I want to stop real quick.
I did the same thing. You shook your head and I was like, oh, did I get that wrong?
No, no, you totally got that right. I'm just more disappointed in Ted.
Yeah.
And here's why. Norma Shearer, who plays Jerry.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. She is gorgeous.
Isn't she?
She is gorgeous. And I was telling Taylor when she joined me about halfway through this movie, I was like, would you like to meet my wife, Norma Shearer, on the screen right now? And she's just so adorable is a good word for it, but she's also just so commanding.
Those eyes.
Those eyes. And like, she looks so good in a hat.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of, you know how sometimes you write a movie off because something happens, you're like, not believable. When Ted's like, yeah, sorry, I had an affair. I'm like, I don't believe you.
Yeah.
How could you have done this?
Yeah.
That makes no sense.
Her eyes, Ted. Look at her eyes.
Well, and, you know, it'd be one thing if it's like, you know, yeah, you know, I kind of got a little more resentful in age and I kind of stopped caring about us. By all means, the way they introduce us 3 years later is that they have an idyllic relationship.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, there's no reason that there would be any kind of trouble in paradise. Mm-hmm. But then he has an affair with Janice.
Right. And they do play it off where he claims, at least, that he was drunk. Mm. It was kind of a one-time thing. Not to justify it, but it's not like this was a first-degree affair or anything. Still, what are you doing, Ted?
Yeah,
what are you doing?
Unreal. It's like, if that was me, this movie would be over. It's the happy couple, not the divorcee.
Right, yeah.
But you're right. So Janice is introduced, and she throws a wrinkle in the plan, and it happens pretty quick that she has alone time with Ted and tries to ask him why he hasn't reached out to her recently. And not a smart idea to do this in the kitchen because Jerry's pretty close by. And Jerry sees this and pretty quickly starts putting a few things together. And one thing that I did like about this is that this could have been like planting seeds of doubt and then Ted never confesses to anything. But now that like that poisoned their relationship a little bit. But it's pretty quick that Ted actually does kind of like open up and he's like, look, here's what actually happened.
Yes.
He tries to write it off a little bit, but it's that same night that he does open up to her about what happened. And I thought that was a little refreshing, right? I feel like the normal thing was to just kind of let it happen and then have her, the movie be like, is she crazy? Is this actually happening? Is it not?
Yeah.
But pretty early on, he's like, no, that's, yeah, to your point, you mentioned drunken mistake.
Sure, sure. That being said, it still ends up haunting Jerry.
Yeah.
Pretty severely. she's not really able to get over the whole idea of Ted. Again, the idyllic husband and the idyllic relationship having any type of issue in it at all. It's really rocking her psyche. And Norma Shearer has some incredible dialogue while she's kind of berating Ted for his crimes, if you will.
Yes.
She's fantastic in this movie. I think her and Chester Morris are both great.
They are.
Norma Shearer, of course, nominated for this film. Quick side note, she wasn't originally...
This is unbelievable to me.
Yeah. Originally, Joan Crawford was set to play Jerry Martin. Norma Shearer arranged a special photo session to convince her husband, Irving Thalberg, to let her have the role. He was the producer of the film.
Right. And here's what is kind of unbelievable to me. That whole aspect of like her auditioning and saying like, no, I should be in the role of Jerry is one thing. And her having to convince her partner is another.
Mm.
The thing that's unbelievable is that he cited that she didn't have enough sex appeal to be in this role.
What? Ted, what are you doing, Ted? What are you doing, Irving? Did you not watch the movie you just made?
It's unreal. Like, it's just, she's so believable as this person who just wants her life to work out.
Yes.
Right? And she's putting everything she has into this relationship. And not even like, I mean, not to sacrifice her beauty, she's incredible. Mm-hmm. And she's so adorable in this movie. I just don't believe that, A, Ted could think that. And to your point, B, her real life husband, the producer of the movie,
yes,
couldn't think that.
Just another example of Hollywood, especially old Hollywood, and just the whole what are you doing aspect of it all.
Just insane. So, truly. I mean, good for her to fight for the role.
Yeah.
But insane that it even had to come up that way.
Totally, totally. And we had seen Joan Crawford briefly in the Hollywood Review. She does the performance, not where she's flipping, that's Bessie Love, but she, I think she does something with Conrad Nagel. If I remember correctly, she sings a song with Conrad, who again is also in this movie. I may be wrong in that, but they were both in that movie. So this is your first opportunity, really, after watching Hollywood Review to see some of MGM's stars play out in actual narrative roles. That's kind of cool. It's exciting.
It is. Yes. And it's not the first time that we've seen Conrad Nagel, obviously, right? We saw him in the Hollywood Review as well. So good to see him return for this. I had a good time with his portrayal here as Ted. Not the most interesting, right? Ted kind of has a little bit of an arc that we'll get to here in a second, but for the most part, he kind of just has to play the Dick Van Dyke role of just, I am husband. I have done wrong. I am sorry. It's really more Jerry's part,
yeah,
to play. That is the core of the movie. So with Jerry now realizing that she's been betrayed, she looks for a shoulder. And she finds that in our grinder monkey himself, Don. And she talks with Don. He convinces her to leave the house.
Yeah.
Have a good time.
Side note, Don is Ted's best friend.
Correct. Yeah. At this time, 3 years later. So is Ted's best friend. And they do go out and they go to the club. And it is heavily shown, or heavily inferred,
mm-hmm,
that they do spend the night together, because you do see the outside of a window with the lights turned off and the shades close. And she comes home the next day to a note from Ted, or a voicemail from Ted. Well, not a voicemail, but at the time it was a letter, right? A letter that was written via, yeah, I called and you weren't home.
Right.
So where do we go from here?
At this point, Jerry doesn't really show a ton of remorse for what she's done.
She's moving slower.
Yes. I think she's very much, her idea was, I want to do this, not because, you know, I want to have an affair or whatever, mm-hmm, but I almost called him Chester. What Ted did to me really messed me up, and I feel like I need to even the score.
She refers to it as balanced the accounts.
Yes. The next morning, or eventually, they're sitting down at the breakfast table, and you can tell she's got something she wants to say. And Ted talks it out of her, and that's what she uses. I've balanced the accounts, nothing more. Ultimately, this leads her to revealing that she has also had an affair. She won't say who it's with, mostly to protect Dawn.
Who requests this?
Yes. This is when the movie takes a huge turn, and I think it requires, it asks a lot of the audience about who is right in this scenario.
Yeah.
Obviously, Ted having the initial drunken affair, bad. Jerry going out and purposefully having an affair to get even, bad. Ted's reaction to finding out about this affair, though, is so hard to watch because it is so hypocritical and full of just this double standard.
Yep.
That I can't imagine anyone, well, I say that, there are lots of people who would be okay with it. The modern audience, though, has got to watch this and be like, that's not, you're not reacting well at all, dude.
Yeah.
You need to calm down. He is very much saying, listen, this isn't right. He gets physical with her at one point. You've got to see it from my point of view, from a man's perspective. I can't have you going around town, you know, sleeping with whoever you want to sleep with. It makes me look bad. And it's very much like he's not calling out the, hey, this really hurt me. It's what will the town think? What will the people think?
It's his pride and his image.
Yes. It's pretty disgusting.
It is. And I think that it's a movie that otherwise you could, like, once Jerry makes that decision, you can say it's a movie where both characters have made mistakes. But now the scores are even, so to speak, right? We both made mistakes in this, but it's Ted's reaction to it that then puts it down to 2-1, right? Because he is outraged. Yes. And he is extremely upset, and it's not emotional. It's not, you know, here's how you've hurt me and I'm sorry I've hurt you, but how can you do this? It really is that public image that you talked about and how he's going to be seen as less of a man.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't able to keep his wife happy, I guess, which is a warped way of looking at it. But obviously in 1930, a warped way to look at it still. But that was unfortunately a way that a man saw marriage.
Right. And it's really sad because you do see Jerry start to show remorse and kind of begin to beg a little bit.
You do.
You know, she speaks her mind. She's like, listen, you hurt me. I did it in return. Deal with it. But the more that Ted starts to push, the more she's like, well, wait a minute. We're good now. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's fine. And he keeps just berating her for what she's done. And she starts to plead with him. Hey, everything's fine. Like, let's just move past this. We're okay. And it's sad that she has reduced herself to this level when he did not on the flip side.
Right.
Ultimately, though, this leads to them separating.
They do get divorced. It's worth noting, just a side note here, Taylor joined me for about halfway through this, and she had told me that she had looked up the plot of The Divorcee, and she told me verbatim, I had it spoiled for me. I know the ending, so I don't know if I'd enjoy it as much. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm watching this movie with the anticipation of like a spoiler, right?
Yeah.
And this is a movie that so far, if you've never seen this and you're just listening to Kyle and I's recounting of it, there's a lot of details. There's a lot of things that happen up front, specifically the disfigurement of Dorothy and Paul being with her. Paul shows back up. We'll talk about him here in a minute.
Yeah.
There's an expectation and there's almost like there's like a mystery to this movie where there's not much narrative going on and you're kind of waiting for something to happen. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but there is a moment where a masked figure appears later on in the movie. And even that kind of adds a little bit of like a horror mystery element of like, what's happening right now?
Yeah.
And you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. You're waiting for like the reveal of something. And I'll go ahead and spoil it right now. There's really nothing to reveal in this movie.
Not really.
No. So there's a lot of things that happen in it that ultimately don't really lead to anything more than just, hey, that happened. I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing about the movie, but it is something that I was kind of expecting like a Hitchcock level, like, hey, actually Janice is Dorothy and you didn't recognize her because of like the horrible disfigurement. Oh, wow. And like, that's the thing. Even Taylor saying spoiler to me, my brain starts like going off and I'm like, oh, what could really be happening? And the reality is that the disfigurement just serves as a reason for Paul to have something to do for 3 years other than chase Jerry.
Yes.
Right? To commit his life now to be with Dorothy. And then you start thinking, well, maybe if he's dedicated his life to Dorothy now, he's found like this thing that he was missing before that finds him as attractive to Jerry, right?
Right.
But then that leads us to our next scene. And because of this fallout and their divorce, Jerry turns herself to just going out and having a good time. And that this is what's interesting. When I say a good time, I don't mean like she's sleeping around. I mean, she's really just going to like clubs and like just having fun with people and like, you know, friends and family, people in general. And Ted's become an alcoholic. So there's multiple scenes where you see men kind of putting their hands on Jerry's hands. And this was, I like this shot a lot, or these series of shots. It's just their hands. You don't see Jerry. You don't see the man that she's talking to. You just see their hands. And they kind of put their hand on hers and say a pickup line. And she just pulls her hand away and says something else.
Yes.
To turn them down. So this shows that she's not really like looking to be in relationships with them. It's more just having conversations and just having fun.
Yeah.
And I thought this was really well done. You know, the idea of showing like, I think it's three or four shots of her turning down several men shows that like she's just not going out and doing whatever she wants to do. She's just trying to like survive and right. just go and have a fun.
Well, before that whole sequence starts of her being out on the town with whoever, she does make the comment to Ted where from this point on, like every man is an option except for you.
Yep.
And I think that one of the flaws in this movie is that while it is implied that she's not out there, you know, just hooking up with whoever, it's not implied heavily enough where you don't think that maybe she did, maybe she didn't with some of these guys.
Sure.
I think if it was made now, you would spend more time in Jerry's era, if you will, of doing all of this and really get to know her character and her thought process. Is she going out to prove a point and to really live by the word she said to Ted of, I'm going to go out and meet people. But the part that you don't know, Ted, is that I am still faithful to you.
Yep.
Or is she actually going out and, you know, if she meets a nice guy or that she's interested in, then sure, whatever. I'd be curious to know how this was originally written in the book and how you're really supposed to feel about Jerry's character at this point. There's a lot of, what do you think she's doing right now as an audience member?
So you're right that it doesn't really paint it one way or the other, but I do think there's enough in the movie that leads you to believe that the truth is that what you said, she's still being faithful to her ex-husband.
Sure.
Right? The sequence of those three shots of her like kind of turning men away, and there's a shot later on of her speaking with a I think what's alluded to a French ambassador, where she's speaking with him, and she kind of like says this line about like, you know, well, of all the men I've been with, but it comes across a little like, you know, she's showing her hand a little bit too much, where you're like, I don't think I believe you. So there's a little bit of like, if you're paying attention, I think they're kind of telling you.
Sure.
But again, that's me reading into it. And you're right that they never confirm this. But even it being called the ex-wife, there's a little bit of like, you know, she believes herself to be of that title, right? Yeah. Like she is the ex-wife, but still has that wife in her title. So she is still kind of like holding true to their relationship. And it's worth noting too, this is also just, you know, maybe this is how much I love Norma Shearer, but, when she does go out with Don, it doesn't seem that clear that her intentions are to like end up sleeping with him. Right? It's just kind of like, well, you know, I need to get my mind off this. Yeah, let's get out of here. And it's not until the drive home that you kind of see like a thought click in her of like, oh, I wonder if this happened. So it does, like, to me, it doesn't seem exactly the same as like, what if I got even? She was drunk. She made the same mistake that he did. Clear.
Yes.
But he doesn't take it that way. He takes it as like a vindictive, like she did this to hurt him.
Right.
Which isn't true.
No, but I think she even presents it at the breakfast table.
She does.
As
hey, we're even.
Yeah. Which nobody in this movie is really a good person.
The grinder guy seems fine.
He's doing a lot of very harsh Italian stereotypes.
Oh, you're right.
So,
You
know who's good in this? Dot.
Dot did nothing wrong.
She did nothing wrong.
This movie happened to Dot.
I feel so bad for Dot.
Yeah.
The entire movie.
Well, audience, you'll see how she comes back up a little later on.
Yeah.
So, while on a train, again, speaking to an aforementioned apparent French ambassador, Jerry catches the eye of Paul, who's also on this train.
What a coincidence.
And Paul immediately comes into the conversation. Ambassador is kicked out of the room. And now it's just Jerry and Paul catching up.
Some good dialogue there, too.
Great dialogue.
With the ambassador.
Yeah.
I wish I could remember it. I need to start writing this down, but he's pretty smooth talker.
He tries to be a smooth talker.
Paul, I mean.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. French ambassador tries his best, but gets kicked out of the room.
Yeah.
And Jerry and Paul catch up, and Paul reveals that he still very much has feelings for her, has always been in love with her, but has been a faithful husband and done his best to do right by Dodd in a situation that otherwise he feels like he has ruined things and ruined lives. So Jerry then has an interest in Paul. This is interesting. This is where, to me, it feels like the movie that runs currently at like 84 minutes is a little overlong. Because now Jerry's, you know, I think that Jerry has been mostly in the right for most of this movie. It's at this point where I don't fully understand. You mentioned that you weren't even really clear that Dot was Jerry's sister.
I still don't know if she is.
It's written online that she might be, or that she is, not that she might be. They may have had that wrong, but I did look up online, they're like, her sister, and I was like, interesting. Even if she's not, let's go ahead and say it's her friend.
Sure.
Right? That then she is estranged from this person, even weirder if it's her sister, but she's estranged from this person, and then agrees to have an affair with her husband after she was disfigured in an accident caused by him.
Yes.
The whole thing just feels very like there's one too many details. It's like when a friend is telling you a story and they add like, you know, oh, and by the way, I was crowned the king of the prom at this place. You're like, that's one too many details where I don't think that happened.
Yeah.
This felt like that, where there's one too many details of, hey, could we just be together? Didn't there not have to be a... Because here's the thing. You take Dorothy out of it and you just make it where like Paul just felt excluded and he like went away and then came back 3 years later. It's the same movie.
Yeah.
There's really no reason for her to be involved.
No, I agree.
We disfigured a woman for no reason.
I think for the next episode we have coming out, All Quiet on the Western Front, I did read a majority of that book to kind of see how it translated. This is one where I would love to read this book as well and see like what details are we missing? What was left out as far as the character building of all of this? Because I also think it's weird that Jerry, super in love with Ted at the beginning of this movie and for 3 years, and now all of a sudden this man who was in her life prior to her marriage with Ted, now all of a sudden she has an interest in him on a romantic level.
Yeah.
But where is your compassion for Dot?
It feels like a movie of conveniences and not a movie of like earnest wanting.
Right.
And earnest interests.
I chalk that up to the adaptation of the novel. And I may be wrong in that, but that's kind of what I'm thinking happened. Don't know.
Well, the next scene that we catch them at is very reminiscent of, to me, we've talked about this multiple times today, so maybe that's just, it's on my brain. It reminded me of Tenet. there's a scene where it cuts to Jerry relaxing on a boat and Paul arrives and talks about how he wants to get married with Jerry, but would have to break it off with Dot, and if she's ready for that journey. And this looks like it was filmed on location. This doesn't look like it was just a screen behind them. It looks like they really are in a boat on the water. And this just reminded me so much of Elizabeth Debicki and Kenneth Branagh in Tenet. And I was just having a little laugh about that. The way she's lounged out on like a chair too. Just
yeah.
The whole thing is just, it very much feels like, hey, this is where the story has to go and not you see why Jerry is doing these things. Because again, she's not acting as, maybe she's trying to be this person who can be with multiple people and sleep with multiple people. But that's not who she has portrayed so far on camera.
Sure.
More to Ted and to Paul and this French ambassador, does she tell them who she wants to be, but not who she is? So this is where it starts getting a little dicey, because you can't tell as an audience if this is like a Seventh Heaven type, hey, what are you inferring from this? Or just, am I misunderstanding the situation here? So this is where it feels a little overlong to me, where it's just kind of gone on a bit. But ultimately they decide, okay, you know what? We are going to get together. I just have to split up with Dot real quick.
Nobody is a good person in this movie.
Dot!
Yeah, Dot.
She's good.
Oh, God, I feel so bad for her. So they have that agreement. We're going to get married. Cool, let's do it. And there is a scene later in the movie where Jerry is at her apartment or wherever she's staying at this point, and I think she's talking to one of her girlfriends, just in general, just having a good old time.
Helen?
Yes. I think Helen is Dot's sister. I think that's what it is.
That might be it. Because she gives her a little information on Helen. She also recently saw Ted in France.
Yes. So she has that conversation, and then I can't remember the order of who shows up, but eventually both Paul and Dot show up in her apartment. And you are not expecting Dot to walk through the door, but she's there to basically say, hey, Jerry,
please don't.
Like, this is all I have. Paul is all I have. I am not going to find anybody else because look at me, which is awful.
She does have a veil over her face.
Yes. He's all I got. And I know that I've been a burden to him, but I need him. And Paul is basically like, listen, I'm not just going to leave you high and dry. I'll keep taking care of you. I've got all this money and you'll live a happy life and blah, blah. And it's like, what are you doing, Paul?
Yeah.
Take it easy, man. This is awful. Like, well, you shouldn't have gotten with...
We're skipping over a little detail where it's Jerry and Dot having this conversation, and then Paul walks in and sees this happening. And Paul's reaction is just kind of like, man, I was so close. Why'd you have to show up? And it just makes you kind of like, that's a turn where you no longer care about Paul.
There's your twist.
Not really. Because it's just him being another guy where he's like, man, I was almost out of this thing.
Yeah.
But you're right. The way that he positions it to Dot doesn't feel like a desperation. It just does feel like he has this warped view of like, hey, look, I did everything I could for you.
Yeah.
Like, this just isn't working out. So
don't I deserve some happiness?
Sure. Look at her. Look at Jerry. Don't you think I'm going to be happy? And it feels very much like, okay, buddy, I'm not on your side anymore. He tries his best. But watching this happen is enough for Jerry to determine that this isn't the right move for her. And she can't take this away from Dot. And this is the last that we see of Dot and Jerry. Or sorry, Dot and Paul.
Yeah.
And this is why I say that there's so many little details in this that don't matter. That it just feels kind of like, I know Dorothy is a character and not like a real person. But why did we have to do this to Dorothy?
Exactly. Yeah. Like you said, Paul would have been the same guy if he had just disappeared and been like, boy, I wish I could have Jerry in my life. And then he just shows up later.
I mean, literally, if he had just drove and like he was drunk driving, crashed the car, no one got hurt. And Ted and Jerry are like, man, glad we survived it. We're going to live our life. And Paul just goes and becomes a recluse for like 3 years. It's the same movie.
Yeah, it's sad that I think the idea is the guilt that Jerry feels towards doing something like that to Dot is what snaps her conscious back in place.
But that should have existed before she arrives in a black veil being like, hey, please don't.
Right.
The whole thing is just, again, it feels like one too many details where you're like, I think you're lying. It's just too much of a story. So she breaks it off. Jerry says, hey, I'm not comfortable with this anymore. I don't think this is the life that we need to live. And you need to be there for Dorothy. And basically talks Paul into continuing his marriage with Dorothy. Which, is it really a happy ending for either of them, honestly?
No.
Maybe Dorothy, that she's like, hey, I'm not going to get anyone better than him. Look at my face. But also don't, because you can't.
I would be miserable the rest of my life.
Yeah.
If that was the experience I had with my husband, you know, who was like, I really want to leave you. But she said no, so okay.
I guess I love you.
Yeah.
She's like, happy ending.
There is no happy ending in this movie for anybody involved.
Well,
who do you think had a happy ending?
We're not leaving the final, or we're not including the final scene here.
Okay.
Final scene is that Jerry does hear that Ted is in France and decides that she does want to try and make this work. So she does end up going to a party on New Year's Eve in France. And it is none other than the Grindr man himself who spots Ted in the building.
Is that true?
I don't know his name. It is true.
Really?
Yeah.
Did I miss that?
So they're sitting at a table in New Year's Eve in Paris, and he's across from Jerry, and he's like, there he is himself right now. And it's the Grindr guy. And he points out Ted, who walked in, and she spots Ted. Ted spots her, and they talk a little bit, and they say that they want to try and make it work, that she still has feelings for him, and they kiss, and it's right at midnight. You're not going to believe it. And you imply that they are now living their lives together, and we have end credits, the end.
Okay, so
where did you think the movie ended?
No, that's where I thought it ended.
Okay, you just didn't know that it's still not that the grinder guy was there.
No, I didn't know the grinder guy was there, and that's hilarious.
I did. Trust me, as soon as the grinder and Paul came out doing the monkey dance, I was like, I'm invested in these two guys.
I just imagine a monkey just like doing his dance, sees Norma Shearer walk in and goes, and just points at Ted.
A much better movie.
Yeah, I would love that. No, I knew it ended here, but when I said that there are no happy endings in this movie, I stand by that.
Yeah.
Because I think that even if these two characters end up together and they have their second chance, I think that all of the actions of the two in this movie...
Indefensible.
Yeah, this is it. This is going to live with both of you for the rest of your life. You're going to be super stressed out the entire time. You're always going to think that the other person is with somebody else. You're kind of hiding romance in this really gross, twisted relationship that you're going to have from here on out. It's an icky feeling.
It is.
I don't like it.
It didn't leave me feeling good.
No.
It did leave me feeling like it did pave the way for some comedy that has happened in the past, I mean, well, you know, 90 years, but specifically in the past 20, 30 years. We talked about with the Love Parade how sex romp kind of became like a category and that paved the way for it. This isn't quite that. This is a little bit more of like a comedy of errors and how that romance can be affected by that. But it did remind me of a few movies, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But it reminded me of the movies that have like come because of it. So I agree with you. It's not a perfect movie, and it's not one that has a very happy ending overall. I think you can kind of infer that there is some happiness to Ted and Jerry being ultimately for each other and trying to make it work again. But it's through such a complicated hurricane of details and events that it just feels kind of like, cool, why did this exist? Why did this movie happen?
Yeah, it's not a feel-good movie. There's
but see, that's the thing, is it's also not like a depressing bummer of a movie. It just kind of is a movie.
Yeah, it's this weird, twisted, romantic kind of comedy, a little bit.
I would say kind of romantic.
Yeah.
Like, it's not even that romantic.
No, it's not. And I think it's one of those things where the selling point of this movie is, here's a bunch of wealthy people. We are, the Great Depression just started.
Yep.
Buckle up, guys. Come spend your money to see a bunch of people who have way more money than you do just kind of be awful. And this is a good example of pre-code film. This is, even the theming of this movie would not fly.
No.
Once the Hays Code comes into effect, this would not exist. The implied sexual nature of all of its characters, big no-no. Unfortunately, a lot of Jerry's behavior, I think specifically, would have been a huge issue.
For sure, which is a double standard.
Absolutely, and this movie's king of the double standard. Yeah, it's always kind of cool to me when we start talking about a movie that was not nominated for like cinematography, that we spend so much time discussing the plot. This movie was nominated for writing. It was nominated for acting from Norma Shearer. There was one other, directing.
That's it.
Directing. So this is, in my mind, like a storytelling movie. And it kind of is just that. You know, our focus is the plot here.
Writing for me is a stretch. Because it doesn't feel like the writing in this is all together. Of the characters, sure. Or I should say of the dialogue, sure.
Yeah.
Of the events, not so much for me.
No, and when I say like what it was nominated for reflects on how we're speaking about the film, I'm not saying the writing was good.
Right.
I'm saying that there's a reason we're not sitting here going, yeah, and then the shot of this was, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's not... The impressive thing about this movie is the same thing that's impressive about every movie we've watched this Academy year thus far, not really including Disraeli, but... You're not
the man's just catching strays left and right on this podcast.
He is. He's going to be in bed
old all Jimmy Neutron
winter because of that. The technical limitations of the time are not seen really in these movies. You can hear what's going on. Yeah. And I don't mean to say that as like sarcastic praise or anything, but we've reached a stride in these movies where they found their footing. They're making movies where they can focus on the plot. They don't have to rely on, hey, we're doing a sound film, that's why you should come see this. The selling point of this movie is the plot.
Correct.
And Norma Shearer, specifically.
Oh, and what a plot she is. Mm-hmm. God, I love Norma Shearer.
She's fantastic.
It's worth noting that there are three shots in this movie that do stand out to me, and I've already mentioned all three of them. So, the cabin from inside, seeing the top floor and the bottom floor, great shot, great design for set design. I don't know if it's a good shot, but the shot of the car when the Paul's driving.
Kandarian demon.
Yep, the Kandarian demon himself. And then I really, really, I don't know if it's an impressive shot. I think it is. But the series of shots of Jerry turning down three men.
Yes.
And how it focuses on their hands. I really like that decision.
Now, I will say that is another great example of pre-code Hollywood. Well, I guess that's a better example of like while the code is in effect.
Right.
They are
what you can show.
Exactly. You're able to tell a story that involves kind of taboo topics in a way that's not going to be banned by the code. So that is a good call out there.
It's those three shots that stand out to me, and it's unfortunate because it feels like if the focus was a bit more on those shots and not just the, I mean, haphazard details of certain characters that don't really amount to much importance, it just feels kind of, you're left wanting.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't want to say it's a bad movie. I enjoyed my time with it fine. And maybe the majority of that is the chemistry between Conrad Nagel and Norma Shearer. And maybe it is just Norma Shearer. She really does command presence of this movie. And while you could assume that, you know, the divorcee and following both Ted and Jerry on this, that either one could be the divorcee. But specifically, the focus is on Jerry. And she is our lead, and she does command every second that she's on screen. But it's just not a very fun watch.
No, it's not.
And to talk about it, it feels kind of like a little bit of a bummer because you want it to be more, and you want it to have more of a meaning and more emotion behind the decisions that are made. But it really is just kind of a confusing story.
Yeah,
that didn't need to be.
You brought it up multiple times at the beginning of this episode. It's like watching an episode of CW teen drama.
Yeah.
And even talking about the movie and just being like, and then Jerry got with Paul, but not after Ted got with Janice, and well, there's a lot of that. And
then Dot's disfigured.
Yes.
And you're like, who's Dot?
You'll see. No, it is kind of, it's certainly not the type of movie that I normally have an interest in. Like you said, the acting, I think, carries a lot of the weight of this movie, and just Norma Shearer being stunning. Chester Morris is great in this too. I enjoy his performance, even though he's a completely unlikable character.
Yeah.
I like him more than I like Conrad Nagel, personally.
Conrad is doing serviceable work.
Yeah.
It's not even that he's bad. He's just not given much to work with.
Yeah.
He kind of has to play like a character who acts deplorably, I should say. He's not quite deplorable, but he doesn't react favorably when he finds out about her affair.
Deplorable and depressy.
Yeah. Stressy and depressy. I do want to mention you brought up the CW, and that's a pretty apt metaphor because specifically in the recap episodes, or the recap of every episode, they show like the very beginning, you know, here's what you missed previously on. And I remember I watched one of One Tree Hill, a CW show. At the time, it was not called CW, but CW. And I remember watching one, and it's just basketball, teen drama, basketball. And then at one point, one of the characters is dressed up as Batman, and he's like threatening another character. And then someone flies through a window, and you're just like, what's going on in this show? And that's kind of this movie. Because if you show me a recap of this movie and like there's drama, who's this? Dot's in a car accident, now she's defigured. I'm like, who's Dot? And then you show me footage of like Paul doing that little monkey walk. I'd be like, what's going on in this movie? So it's a really good metaphor because it does, or comparison, because it does feel like a movie of just things happen.
Yeah.
And it doesn't try to connect those dots that much. It's also worth noting that Paul does that dance like two more times. When they're like, hey,
Paul or Don?
Don, I'm sorry, not Paul. Yeah, Don does do the dance.
Paul would never.
But Don does do the dance. They're like, all right, guys, let's get out of here. And he just like does the little dance out the door. Again, lost my mind.
I want you to do like a fan edit of a trailer for this movie and just make it the weirdest thing.
It's just set to, it's only Don and the problematic Italian impression guy. But it's set to Billie Eilish's Birds of a Feather.
Oh, okay. I was thinking of, like, what is it, Little Green Bag?
No, I was thinking more like those, like, sweet little, like, videos where, like, the image, like, is, like, turned sideways and sometimes warps in. No, I'm thinking that, okay. But just of him doing the walk and the grinder. Guy just, like, turning the wheel.
Yeah, Dot walks in with her veil on, and you're just like, wait. Is this a horror movie?
So I'm talking less about a recap episode, and I'm more making a fan edit of Dawn, specifically.
Yeah.
So that's where my head's at, is I'm just making a Dawn fan edit of Birds of a Feather.
Big Dawn fan over here.
I love Norma Shearer in this movie, but a close second is Dawn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert Montgomery actually is pretty good in this movie.
He is. Yeah, he is. And he kind of, this will lead pretty well to our double feature here in a minute, but he does provide a lot of good comedic relief in a movie that otherwise is just like kind of a serial drama.
Yeah, really dry.
Dry.
I think when this, like, hey, let's watch wealthy people kind of
we have
awful.
Problems too.
Yeah. That's a tough one for me.
Yeah.
So thanks, Don, for doing your monkey thing, I guess.
I do like the idea that none of that was written in the script. And Robert Montgomery was like, we really need to liven this thing up a little bit. He's like, look what I can do.
Look what I can do. Real quick, fun fact about this. We mentioned Norma Shearer had to do this whole audition process for her husband.
Insane.
Absolutely wild. Did you catch who did the sound mixing for this movie?
I don't think I did.
You didn't. It was Douglas Shearer, her older brother. Why are you laughing?
I'm laughing because I'm just thinking now about, like, furthering the plot. And what if she's like, ah, he didn't pick me, whatever. And Doug, like, really needs a job. He's like, you know what you should do?
Yeah.
You should prove to him that you have the sex appeal to be in this movie.
It was a twofer.
And then get me to work on sound. That's the only reason I laughed. But gotcha. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. He's a 7-time Academy Award winner, Douglas Shearer. Yeah, big name we'll be talking about a lot.
Did he have any recognition prior to this, or did he win those awards after?
No, he's a big, big name.
Wow.
Yeah. Douglas Shearer, MGM, basically head of the sound department for, like, it looks like 40 years or something like
that. Oh, my God.
So let's talk real quick, physical media.
Yeah.
Something I want to start adding into the show is where this was released, how it was released. I've kind of tasked you with being the head of that.
You did.
Because you're the physical media guy.
Thank you. So, a couple things about the physical media of this. Mm-hmm. It was in 2008 that Warner Home Video did release this on DVD. However, wasn't on its own. It was part of a box set, specifically of 5 pre-code films, and it was called Forbidden Hollywood Collection Volume 2.
Nice.
Gotta tell you, this movie doesn't feel like a forbidden kind of thing. I do understand what it's going for, but Forbidden Hollywood, it's not exactly what I would call this. Feels more a reaction to code than, like, at the time feeling forbidden.
Yeah, and that's interesting because it's one of those movies that I think has a reputation now because of the events that took place in history, really, with the code coming into place. Had that not happened and this kind of be such a standout during the pre-code era, you know, obviously it has its outstanding picture nomination and Norma Shearer's performance and all of that, but I think it being that and a pre-code film says a lot.
It does, and it's also worth noting that while it was released on this box set of Forbidden Hollywood Collection Volume 2, it actually didn't have its own disc. It did share a disc with a film from 1931 called The Free Soul, and you're never going to believe who starred in that.
Is it Norma?
Norma Shearer.
I'll watch it.
So it's a Norma Shearer disc with a Norma Shearer double feature, but it is not a specific disc for The Divorcee.
Interesting.
Which then begs the question. In 2008, this was released.
Yep.
It is available on Tubi and YouTube. So why isn't this available on its own?
Yeah.
Why isn't this a Blu-ray? Why isn't Criterion, you know, pick this up? Not that it's on Criterion to pick up every film that's not there.
Sure.
And it kind of begs the question then of, you know, we are going to talk about All Quiet on the Western Front and how that does exist on Blu-ray. Universal released a 100-year celebration of their production studio and then released there's been physical copies of this, but a hardback physical book edition of the Blu-ray and DVD. So I wonder if there's something about pre-code films. Criterion had to pick up Love Parade. right? We're not seeing a lot of studios put out these films pre-code. I wonder if there's almost like a sweep it under the rug kind of element of pre-code versus code that studios have that other production companies like Criterion doesn't so much concern themselves with. Mm-hmm. We'll talk a little bit later in the podcast, not this episode, but in the future, about, you know, the front page, His Girl Friday.
Yeah.
The pre-code version of His Girl Friday being front page. Criterion picked that up. But even that is only a two-pack with the His Girl Friday Criterion release.
Right.
So you can't get that individually. What do you think about the idea that studios may be trying to overlook and not put a spotlight on pre-code films?
I think that it is a financial decision. I think that it is probably much more easy to market a Forbidden Hollywood collection from someone who is a silent film fan or a pre-code film fan. When you make like a collection of those movies, you're probably going to sell more of those also at a higher price for these movies that a lot of them are getting close to being public domain films. Probably going to have an easier time selling those than individual copies of The Divorcee or The Love Parade. Also in a collection, you know, with Criterion.
True.
So there's that. That's probably a big push there. It's not so much that they're not trying to give them the spotlight. It's they're trying to capitalize as much they can.
And I'm not going to say anything that's going to surprise you, but it is a bit of a heartbreak and a bummer that we're expected to focus a little bit more on Forbidden Hollywood than we are a Best Picture nominee. Right? Like, this isn't just any film. Like, this was nominated for the top prize in Hollywood. And granted, we're only in the third year where that's, like, not seen quite as prestigiously. But especially in hindsight, in 2025, we can look back and say, well, that was nominated. So shouldn't we put that as, like, you know, a collection of, like, nominees? Ideally, and I know this is never going to happen because there's way too many studio involvement, mm-hmm. or way too many studios involved to pull this off. But I would love to see, like, you know, the 1930, like, Oscar nominees, the 1931 Oscar nominees for Best Picture as a collection. And it's never going to happen because obviously multiple studios are putting out multiple films for each year, and they're not going to collab on that. But we need something if they're not going to be putting it out individually.
Yeah.
So, short answer to your question on physical media, it is technically available on a DVD box set released in 2008 called Forbidden Hollywood Volume 2. But it is not even available as an individual disc or anywhere outside of that box set.
I will say, I went back and I looked at some of the movies we already covered just for my own personal interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I typed in The Divorcee. I did see it pop up as a coming soon. No date announced or anything like that.
Interesting.
Who knows how much truth is behind that? But from what I saw on Blu-ray.com, there is a potential that this might be getting its own individual release of some sort in the coming future.
I'm just so proud of us that in only the few months that we've been doing this iteration of the podcast, that we've done enough work to make Blu-ray and MGM or any other studio look back and be like, man, we got to do this, guys. Yeah. Ryan and Kyle are getting just digging into us about this. Exactly. So I guess what I'm trying to say is congratulations to us for single-handedly bringing The Divorcee to Blu-ray coming soon.
You know, I think it's an important job, and who better to do it than two guys sitting in a room with a Death Bat poster, you know, clearly a massive fan of old Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
And Avenged Sevenfold.
Even a Hollywood that was once undead.
Oh, my God. Incredible. Incredible. Let's do ratings, and then we'll cover our double feature.
Great. What do you have?
I gave this 3 stars. It's middle of the road for me. I don't know. I enjoyed it, but I didn't enjoy it. It's really bizarre kind of how I felt about this movie.
Does feel middle of the road, right? 2.5 would technically be the half point for your 5 stars.
Damn,
but
you're right.
I agree with 3 for one reason. 2.5 for the movie.
Mm.
Well, let's say this. 2.5 for the movie, specifically carried by Norma Shearer.
Yes.
0.5 for Robert Montgomery's portrayal as a grinder monkey for roughly 2 to 3 scenes of this movie.
That's fair.
But I agree with a 3. I think a 3 sounds right because, again, I didn't dislike my time with this. And I did have a good enough time, but a lot of it was chin scratching, where if there was some kind of like Hitchcock level reveal of like, you know, why Dot was disfigured or why she had to be disfigured for the story,
yeah,
and her appearance in it, and she's like portraying someone who no one recognized because she's not recognizable herself, I'd kind of get that. And maybe it's a game played by Paul and Dot who felt outside of Ted and Jerry's relationship. There's an interesting dynamic there, mm-hmm, that isn't just, I guess we ruined each other's lives by accident, but let's get back together. And that being the core focus of the movie. And maybe we ruin the lives of other people at the same time, but also decide not to because that would be wrong. Mm. It just kind of feels like, hey, look, I didn't do that bad of a job of a movie. So yeah, 3 sounds about right for me. Just kind of a very confusing experience of a movie.
Yeah. Maybe one day I'll read the book.
It doesn't really inspire confidence in you to go and do that after watching this, does it?
No.
Yeah.
How about double features?
Let's double feature it up. So, do you need time? I know you were a little perplexed about the double feature for this one. Really?
I'm ready.
Okay. What do you think? Do you want to go? You want me to go first?
You go first this time. You said you weren't feeling great about yours.
Well, here's the thing. I'm confident of what mine's going to be. I just don't feel good about it.
Okay.
Right? It's kind of like when you bunt in baseball and you're like, well, this is going to get me what I want, but do I feel good about this?
Yeah. The audience won't like it.
The audience won't like it, but it is technically correct.
Cool. Can't wait for our audience to not like this segment of the podcast.
I think they'll like it just fine. You're really doing numbers with Muppet Vision and Jimmy Neutron, by the way. So, yeah?
Yes.
Kudos to you. Really thought it was weird that you suggested Tower of Terror for one All Quiet on the Western Front up front, but we'll talk about that later.
Well, you know,
so
scary.
I had a very like vivid thought while I was watching this movie, The Divorcee. And it was the concept of two people who were very much interested in the idea of each other, but couldn't pull off the commitment level of what it took to be together. And you're watching them explore throughout this movie, albeit, you know, more in The Divorcee, it's from Jerry's point of view, but you are watching these two people battle with the idea of what it means to be together and if they should be together. You partner that with the idea of these side characters that are bringing comedy to this, right? A sense of comedic relief, whether it be through dancing like a monkey or just being a, you know, person who was, this isn't quite funny, but being disfigured in a car crash and then just being used as a side character.
Yeah.
Very funny, morbid thing that the movie does, but not funny from her point of view. And this reminded me of the Vince Vaughn, Jennifer Aniston rom-com, The Breakup.
Oh, no.
And I specifically thought of Robert Montgomery's Dawn doing the dance that I so love.
Mm-hmm.
As the character played by, oh my God, I'm forgetting his name. He's in all of the great Christopher Guest movies. He's a judge in Pitch Perfect. John Michael Higgins, I think is his name. Might just be Michael Higgins.
The man who's passed away. Phil Dunphy's father on...
No. Mm-mm. It's not Fred Willard.
Oh, okay.
You are thinking of Fred Willard. He did play... I remember that now, but that's not him. It's John Michael Higgins.
Gotcha.
John Michael Higgins plays Richard Myers, and he specifically has a really unforgettable scene, especially in my household, where he introduces the idea of singing Owner of a Broken Heart to the entire table at this party. And he says a phrase, comes the kick drum, or come on the kick drum, because he's trying to make Vince Vaughn do the kick drum part of Owner of a Lonely Heart, and he won't. And that's a movie that is very much a comedy, but John Michael Higgins is very much the whole, like, who the hell is this guy role, and that's what I felt when I saw Dawn, was like, what is this guy doing? So there's the aspect of, like, a surprise comedic relief and the... will they, won't they, eternal battle. And even kind of the open-ended nature of Divorcee, although I think it does kind of point towards, you know, they do get back together. That was a nice comparison to the end of The Breakup that kind of refreshingly was like, maybe we shouldn't be together. And ending a movie that is quite literally called The Breakup with a breakup. So
interesting.
I thought that was an apt comparison. I don't feel great about it, but I do think that it is correct.
No, I mean, you've picked a movie that the title is...
the plot.
People getting separated.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it makes sense to me. I will say two things here. One, you have continued the tradition of all of your double features being movies that I've not seen.
I love that I'm doing this.
It's kind of astounding how you're able to do that every time.
I technically, in a future episode, mentioned two movies. Have you not seen either of those two?
Let me
see.
I know you didn't see one of them.
No, I have seen one of them.
Oh, there you go.
Yes.
We're getting there.
But I didn't count that as your double feature. That won't be listed on the Once Upon a Time at the Oscars
Dang it.
List. So, second thing to that, though, here's a little lore for you guys at home. I can't stand Vince Vaughn.
I don't think that's an unpopular opinion.
I don't think so either, but...
He's fine. I think he is very much the kind of actor where he tells you up front, hey, here's what I'm going to give you. And you're like, cool, man, what else you got? And he's like, that's it.
Yeah, except he goes, all right, here's what I'm going to give you. I really don't care if you like it or not, but you're going to deal with it anyway. So that's what I'm saying. I'm exhausted.
You're telling me that you don't appreciate the cinematic masterpiece that is Paul Giamatti and Vince Vaughn in Fred Claus?
Again, a movie I've not seen.
Where he plays Santa Claus's brother, Fred?
What? My double feature. So this is a weird one. And I wanted to go with something that involved the wealthy.
Sure.
I wanted to do something that involved infidelity.
Hard to do with the wealthy.
Yeah. But I wanted to do something that didn't completely exhaust me from viewing those types of movies because I'm just not into them.
Sure.
So there's a little bit of weird horror when Dot walks in with that veil
it
over
is,
her
yeah.
face.
Infamously, I expected a twist.
So I'm going to go with Gothic horror in Crimson Peak.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Oh, great pick.
So, I mean, you've got people that just bought this. I think they bought it. They inherited it.
Yeah.
This beautiful manor. And you have the relationships, Tom Hiddleston and the other people in that
Jessica
movie.
Jessica Chastain.
That I forgot.
Yeah.
Jessica Chastain. Wow. I just worked on a movie that she's in. And I'm so sad that I didn't get to see her.
Well, it's timely, too, because Frankenstein was released just last month.
There you go. There you go. So, Guillermo del Toro. No, I think it's an interesting comparison that really doesn't make complete sense. But if you add the infidelity and the wealthy aspect of it, it doesn't have that, like, yeah, I get it. You're rich. You're on a yacht. Cool. Oh, you're taking a train across the country. Must be nice.
Yeah.
Every time you feel that way in Crimson Peak, a big scary ghost, Javier Bardem, shows up and you're like, ugh.
Yeah.
So
that's something that the divorcee could have used was a red corpse skeleton bride.
Yeah.
So
that's Javier Bardem in that, right? Or is it Doug Jones?
Are you suggesting that the creature, like the skeleton thing,
yeah,
is Javier Bardem?
Yes.
No, it's definitely Doug Jones.
It is Doug Jones.
Because Javier Bardem, I was like, oh, I don't remember him in that movie. But I know for certain that Javier Bardem is not putting on prosthetic makeup.
Wait a minute. What's the guy's name that does all the scary monsters?
Doug Jones.
The other one. This very thin man. Javier.
That's not Javier Bardem. It's not. I guarantee
it's,
that.
It's not. Now, the more you've said it. The more you said it, I know.
Well,
it's
I believed
not.
You. I was like, oh, I don't remember him being in that movie. But when you were like, he plays like the very thin corpse bride, I was like, nope. Pretty sure that's not it.
Please forgive me. It is Javier Botet.
You got the Javier B, though.
I okay, got,
I
yes.
see what you did. It's okay.
I mean, yeah, he was in Mama. He was Slender Man.
Oh.
He's spooky.
He is
I think
spooky.
He's the tall, gangly man in Conjuring 2 with a hat.
The Crooked Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. My guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I love the Crooked
he's
Man.
He's the other Doug Jones.
I think that it is criminal. And put this on my tombstone.
Okay.
It is criminal that we got two Nun movies
mm-hmm.
and technically The Curse of La Llorona. They, depending on how well the movie is doing, Warner Brothers will be like, hey, that's part of the Conjuring universe.
Right.
And then like it doesn't do well one week and they're like, we've never heard of that movie before in our life. So I think it's criminal that we've gotten as many Annabelle movies as we did, four Conjuring movies, two Nun movies, and we've gotten one Crooked Man movie.
Yeah.
That was terrifying.
And none of them starred Javier Bardem.
Javier Bardem is the Crooked Man.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my
technically, that could have been the name of No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
He
yeah.
is the Crooked Man.
You're right. You're right.
He's pretty crooked in that
movie. He's
very
crooked. Hair straight.
He's got an FAB in that movie.
Yeah.
That Bob is doing something.
Let's wrap this up.
I think we're doing great.
We are. We're doing great. That's what we've got to say about The Divorcee. Check it out. I mean, check them all out.
I mean, look, for the historical side, it's worth checking out for sure. But
always.
I agree with you that it's not the most fun watch that we've had this season. Yep. Not the worst.
No.
Thank you, Disraeli. Hope you feel better from your cold.
Yep. But still an exciting year overall. Yeah. It's so cool, the quality that has come out of this year. So if you have thoughts and opinions about The Divorcee, or any other movies from this Academy year, send us an email at outaopodcast@gmail.com. Check out our Patreon account, patreon.com/outaopodcast. By the time you're listening to this, if you check out that Patreon, the poll, exclusive for Patreon members, will be up, where you get to vote on what film from this Academy year you think truly deserved the Best Picture win. Those winners get put into a list on our Letterboxd page, the Once Upon a Time at the Oscars Letterboxd page. Get excited for next episode as well. We'll be talking about All Quiet on the Western Front with a very special guest.
It is a very special guest. Do we want a little tease?
Yeah, go for it.
I've talked to him before.
Yeah, I hadn't.
It's my buddy Jordan. Yeah. I'm very much looking forward to having Jordan of Cinema Showdown, It's All in My Head, one episode of Commentary Men, Mickey Mutineers. He is a historian, and he is going to join us to talk about the 1930 Lewis Milestone classic, All Quiet on the Western Front, because he does specialize in World War I.
Incredible credentials.
Yes, so. That I did not give you ahead of time.
No, it's very funny. But yeah, so stay tuned for that. Get excited for that guest episode, our first guest episode. I'm really excited about it. And beyond that...
When does that come out, Kyle?
That's actually going to be Christmas Eve. Thank you so much for that. And again, we didn't say it in that episode, but if you celebrate, Merry Christmas. All of these are coming out in December.
Yep.
We are getting close to wrapping up season one of the podcast. We'll be ending New Year's Eve. That'll be the last episode, the third ceremony episode. And then we'll take a brief hiatus in December. Come back strong midway through January for our 2026 Academy coverage, I guess. Academy Absolutely. Award coverage.
And make sure you follow us on Instagram and Discord, because, again, Discord is through the Patreon. But with Instagram specifically, we are going to be talking a bit about, you know, when the Golden Globes happen and what nominees come out of that. What we've seen, what we're looking forward to seeing. We'll talk a little bit about that before we come back from our break in January.
Yeah, yeah. The socials are going to be more day in the life kind of videos and things.
For sure.
But that's all I've got. That's going to do it for today's episode. As always, I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Ryan.
And we'll
see you at the movies.